Okay, good morning, everybody. This is Bible 231. It's August 30th, and we're going to finish up histology, move into integument today. And we have one screen working, so that's could be worse. All right, so don't forget what happens tomorrow night at 11. Yeah, another quiz. And probably the most important thing besides answering the questions correctly is hit save and submit button at the very bottom of the quiz. If you do that, the quiz gets automatically graded and the grades put into your grade book. If you don't hit save and submit, the computer doesn't know that you're done taking the quiz and it causes problems. So make sure you hit save and submit at the bottom of the quiz. And this week there are two chapters on the quiz, the histology as well as integument. So today we're going to cover some of the integument. All right, so let's see. All right, so last time we were talking about tissues. And I think we got through most of the tissues. We even got to nervous tissue. But what we didn't talk about yet were some membranes. All right? And this is maybe a little bit of a review from the first chapter. Okay? So there are basically two kinds of membranes. Where does it go? Hold on. Let me find out where it's going. What a pain. So it's over on the different screen. Okay, I think this is going to work. Can I get a cursor over? I can get a cursor over here. Fantastic. Okay, so there are two main kinds of membranes in the body. The first is what we call a mucous membrane. So number one, mucus. All right, so notice how I spell that, M-U-C-O-U-S. That means that it's an adjective. If we leave out the O and just spell it M-U-C-U-S, then that's a noun, which stands for that stuff that dribbles out of your nose when you have a cold, right? So there's a difference between mucus and mucus, right? So a mucus membrane that's used as an adjective is a membrane that lines a cavity that's open to the outside world. Like the oral cavity is a mucus membrane. Nasal cavity, mucus membrane. The digestive tract is a mucous membrane lining that because, of course, it's open to the outside world as well. The other kind of membrane is called a serous membrane. That lines a cavity that is not open to the outside world. Could you think of a cavity that's not open to the outside world that you had to know? For thoracic cavity. Sure, thoracic cavity is a serous membrane. And a serous membrane has got three parts to it. All right, and I'll just put three little dashes right here. There is the parietal division. There is the visceral part to it. And then there's a space between these two membranes, right, which we call the serous cavity, filled with serous fluid. All right, so here we see a couple membranes, all right, and this yellow right here represents a membrane that's lining the oral cavity that's open to the outside world. So what kind of these two major ones, what kind is that? That's a mucous membrane. Not all mucous membranes secrete mucus, but most do, all right, including all of these linings on the inside surface of the lung. All right, those are mucous membranes. All right, now here is a membrane that surrounds the pleural cavity, which is a division of the thoracic cavity. And this right here is a serous membrane. The membrane that sits right on the surface of the lung, that's the visceral division. And then the part that is right on the wall of the thoracic cavity, that's the parietal division. And then there's a space between them filled with fluid, and that's just the serous cavity filled with serous fluid. All right, so there are some other cavities inside your body. Let's really zoom into this one right here. Ah, really good. All right, so here is what the pleural cavity once again. So here is the visceral serous membrane, pleural membrane on the lung. This is the parietal division, and there's some serous fluid in between these two. Here is the membrane that surrounds the heart. That's what we call the pericardial cavity. And again, that's not a mucous membrane because the heart's not open to the outside world. That's a serous membrane. The division that's right on the surface of the heart is the visceral pericardium. And the one that's on the lining of the pericardial cavity right here, that's the parietal division of the pericardium. And then there's some pericardial fluid in that serous cavity right there. All right, so that's what you have to know about those membranes. The other thing over here, there's another important cavity, and that's the peritoneal cavity. Remember, the peritoneum is the same thing as the abdominal pelvic cavity. And the division that is right on the body wall right here, this is the parietal division of the peritoneum. And the membrane that's right on the visceral organs right here, that's the visceral peritoneum. And then you have serous fluid in between those in that serous cavity. Okay. And an inflammation of this cavity right here, maybe if you have an appendicitis, maybe that burst, then we would call that what? A peritonitis. All right, so peritonitis is an inflammation of the peritoneum. Pericarditis is an inflammation of the pericardial space. And an inflammation of the pleural cavity is called pleurisy. It's a little bit different kind of term. Okay. Let me see what I can get going over here. Ah, this is nice. This is nice. All right, so I think that's it for chapter 4. Okay, we did have to cover these cavities right here. All right, so let's move on to the skin, right? And another name for skin is integument. And that's chapter 5. Okay, so the integumentary system is the largest organ system in your body. It completely covers your body. It's composed of skin and some accessory structures that are associated with the skin. And those accessory structures are hair and nails, some glands, and a little tiny muscle that we're going to look at. All right, so don't forget, you can download these slides if you don't feel like copying all of this stuff. All right, and the functions of skin, all right, protecting internal structures from infection. That's a very important function of the skin. And it also protects you from dehydrating. You would dehydrate in just a matter of minutes without the skin. You would just turn into a potato chip. And you'd get a very serious infection just within a matter of hours, which would be fatal. All right. Another important function of the skin, of course, maybe you're kind of aware of, when your body temperature rises, you start to sweat, and that cools you down, right? So temperature regulation, another important function of the integument. And then lastly, in the last couple of years, a lot of people have been making a big deal of this in the news, and that is that you need some sunlight to make a precursor for vitamin D. And vitamin D is very important for calcium metabolism in your body, maintaining bones. All right, and then, of course, sensation. You communicate with your environment quite a bit with your skin. All right, so what kind of sensations do you recall on the surface of your skin? Like what? What can you feel? Yeah, for instance, when the wind blows, it blows the hairs on your skin, and you can feel that. When the wind blows, it also cools your skin off, and you can feel that change in temperature. So you can feel hot and cold on the surface of your skin. You can feel vibration, for instance, with different receptors that are in your skin. So there's a lot of different kinds of sensations that you can feel with your skin, including pain, for instance. And that's very important to feel pain, because you certainly would like to know when a certain part of your body is being damaged so that you can withdraw that part of your body from that damaging stimulus, whether it's temperature, right, or abrasion or whatever. All right, so let's talk about the skin first. There are two main layers that make up the skin. The superficial layer is epidermis, and when you hear that term epi, that just means on top of. So the epidermis is on top of what? The dermis. The dermis is the deeper layer, which we're going to take a look at. And then there is another layer that we talk about in this chapter. It's not really part of the integument, but it fits really nice in with this chapter. And we call it the hypodermis. And you find that where? Below, because that's what hypo means. Hypo means below, epi means on top of. All right, the epidermis, right, that's the superficial layer. That's an epithelium. Remember, an epithelium covers a surface. And it's a stratified squamous epithelium. Depending on where in the body you look, it's either 4 or 5 layers thick. All right, so let's take a look at a pretty good picture. Here's an exam figure right here that shows the skin. And I think I maybe just want to fill this up to full screen, make it as big as we can get it. All right, so the three layers we're talking about, epidermis goes from here to here. It's composed of 4 to 5 layers. And then from here down to here is the dermis. That's composed of 2 layers that we're going to become familiar with. And then here is the hypodermis. Sometimes we call that the superficial fascia. And the superficial fascia is just a loose connective tissue that helps attach your skin to underlying structures like muscle and bone and things like that. So it's a connective tissue. But we store a lot of fat in that loose connective tissue. Hence, you see all of these globules of fat right here. That's probably not really adipocytes, but it is adipose tissue. Right? Adipocytes would be really, really small. It would be hard to see them. All right, so that's the integument plus hypodermis. The layers of the dermis, this top layer right here is what we call the papillary region, and it's an areolar kind of connective tissue. It's a loose connective tissue. And then the deep layer of the dermis right here, we call that the reticular layer, that's dense, irregular connective tissue. So if I say dense, irregular, what does that mean to you? What do you know about dense, irregular connective tissues? It's got what kind of chemical in it? What kind of fiber? Collagen. It's loaded with collagen fibers oriented in all different directions and some elastic fibers. So your skin is kind of stretchy, but it's also kind of strong. right? Because of this reticular layer, because it's loaded with collagen. As a matter of fact, right, when you buy a leather product of some kind, that leather is basically what? Just a reticular layer from some animal, right? Like a cow or something. And leather is really tough because of all the collagen fibers in it. All right, when you buy leather, right, it no longer has any epidermis, no longer has any papillary layers because those layers would rot and stink. Those are removed, and the collagen is maintained. Okay, so let's look in particular at the epidermis. We said that there are four or five different layers right there. And here is, this right here is what we call a dermal papillae. Let me go back a couple slides. These little projections of the dermis up into the epidermis, we call that a dermal papillae. And they contain blood vessels. Here I see some blood vessels in a dermal papillae. That's a nice vascular plexus. And what is one strange characteristic of an epithelium? No blood vessels, right? So I don't see any blood vessels in here. The closest they get are in these dermal papillae. And only these first basal layers of the epidermis are alive because those are the ones that are close to these capillaries. As you move farther and farther away, these cells of the epidermis actually die out because they don't have oxygen and nutrients. And these dermal papillae can group together to form on the palms of your hand, soles of your feet, things that we call fingerprints. They form ridges, right, when these dermal papillae aggregate. All right, so let's look at this picture once again. So here's a little dermal papillae poking up into the epidermis. This first layer right here, usually it's about 1 to 2 cell layers thick. This is what we call the stratum basale. This is the layer that's alive and it's undergoing mitosis because it is regenerating your epithelium. The cells move from the basal layer to the superficial, and when they get to the top, they just fall off your body, right? Your clothes rub them off, you bump into stuff, they rub off. But this stratified squamous epithelium is designed to rub off, but they're constantly being replaced by these cells in the stratum basale. All right, the next layer right here, you see that the cells change shape. Instead of being kind of cuboidal in the stratum basale, they kind of turn into more squamous kind of cells. And they start to stick together because there are desmosomes that connect the cells, and they form little spiny processes between them. So this is what we call the stratum spinosum. And these cells right here start to produce a chemical called keratin. Now, this is an epidermis, not a connective tissue, so that keratin isn't secreted into the matrix because there is no matrix in the epidermis, right? That keratin stays within the cell. So these flat cells right here we call keratinocytes. Keratin is a hard chemical which makes your skin kind of hard, gives it some strength. All right, then they move up into the next layer right here, and you can see some granules in these cells. So this is the stratum granulosum. And these granules right here are making a waterproofing lipid kind of compound because what was one of the main functions of skin? It kind of acts like a saran wrap to what? Keep water inside your body, keep you from dehydrating. And those lipid molecules, that's a nice vapor barrier that prevents your skin from dehydrating. All right, and keratin gets into a little bit more of a mature form. And then the cells move up into the stratum corneum. Now these cells in the stratum corneum, or these keratinocytes right here, are filled with keratin. And they're dead. They don't have any functioning organelles, but they're completely filled with keratin. And that's really the layer that gives your epidermis strength because of keratin. Now, you should be able to contrast keratin with collagen. Both are very strong molecules. Collagen is, how would you characterize collagen? As a, what kind of molecule does it look like? A glob? No, it's a fiber, right? And where do you find that fiber? Is it intracellular or extracellular? It's extracellular. It's in the matrix, right? So collagen is a fiber that is extracellular. Keratin, on the other hand, is a strong chemical that is intracellular. It's inside these keratinocytes right here, right? There's no matrix in skin. All right, so I do want you to know these different layers of the skin. Here is a nice illustration. I think this is an exam figure. Right, here's that dermal papillae once again poking up into the dermis. Here's the stratum basale, right? And then you can see the little spiny areas right here. So this is the stratum spinosum. And then I see some granules in this layer right here. That's the stratum granulosum. And then this is the dead layer of cornified cells. And cornified cells just mean really hard, dead cells. And so this is the stratum corneum right here. All right, so most of these cells that we're looking at are keratinocytes because they produce keratin. But there are a couple other cell types in here as well. All right, if we look at the stratum basale, here is a cell that we call a melanocyte. And a melanocyte produces a chemical compound that stays with inside the cell, kind of like keratin, but it's got a totally different function. And it's got a totally different name. It's not keratin, it's actually named after the cell. It's called melanin. And melanin is a pigment. A pigment is something that gives color to substances. So if we have sunlight and we pass it through a prism, what happens to sunlight? It gets broken down into all the colors of the rainbow, right? So in sunlight, there's all different kinds of colors or energy levels or wavelengths, however you want to talk about it. And a pigment is a chemical compound that will absorb some of the colors and reflect other colors back to your eye. Like, for instance, like your chairs, to me, kind of look yellow. Do they look yellow to you? I'm really close, okay? So the kind of pigment in those chairs will absorb blue light and red light and orange and green, but reflect yellow back to your eye, all right? So yellow is the color that's reflected, not absorbed, right? That yellow pigment absorbs all other colors except for yellow. Now, melanin, right, is a pigment. It absorbs a lot of different colors as well as ultraviolet light. And ultraviolet light is very damaging to the skin and to underlying structures. It can cause mutations and it can cause cell death and premature aging of skin cells. All right, so melanin is a pigment that looks brown to black, and it absorbs all those harmful energies coming from the sun, and it protects a person's skin and underlying structures from sunlight. So melanin, you should think of as a natural sunscreen, right? It's a very important compound, and we all have different amounts of melanin. Some of our skin is very, very dark, which means we have, a high degree of protection from sunlight. And if your skin is very, very light and kind of pinkish, that means that your melanocytes don't produce very much melanin, and you're very susceptible to sunburn when you go outside. You could probably burn in just a matter of a minute or 2 minutes in the summertime, right? So you have to protect yourself with hats, clothing, sunblock, things of that nature. And the most damaging thing you can do to your skin is to go out in sunlight. That's what ages skin the most compared to almost any other thing we do to ourselves. All right, so you really should protect yourself from sunlight, unless you have really dark skin, because these melanocytes are doing a good job protecting you from the harmful rays of the sun. So this is a melanocyte right here. There's another cell that sort of looks like a melanocyte. It has these projections coming off of it. That's a Langerhans cell. Sometimes we call that a dendritic cell. And that's an immune cell that fights infection. That's going around looking for bacteria and fungi and viruses that don't belong. And it kills them so that you don't get a skin infection. And then you have some tactile cells right here. This little Merkel's disc right here is important for tactile sensation, for touch. Very, very light, discriminative touch. Right? You don't need a lot of pressure to excite these, and here you can see a sensory nerve ending attaching to that tactile cell right there. All right, so I do want you to know the layers, right? The deepest layer is the basale, then spinosum, and then granulosum, and then stratum corneum in this particular slide right here. Now, there are two kinds of skin. Skin over most of your body is what we call thin skin, and it has these four layers. There's another kind that you have that's tougher, that's on the palms of your hands and on your fingers, soles of your feet, and it has an additional layer, and the stratum corneum is actually a lot thicker, and we call that thick skin. All right, so let me see if I can find a picture of that kind of skin anywhere. Right here is probably pretty good. All right, so here is a basement membrane. Everything above that is epidermis. Everything down below is the dermis, right? So let's pay attention to the epidermis right here. So we have the first layer, that's the stratum basale, and you might actually see some You see some brownish coloring right in this region right here. That's because there are some melanocytes in this area that are producing pigment. All right, so here is the stratum basale. Then we got the stratum spinosum. And then this layer here has got some granules in it. That's the stratum granulosum. And then right superficial to that, right above that, I see a clear area. All right, and when you're speaking clearly to somebody, we say that person is speaking lucidly, very clearly, right? So lucidum means clear layer. So that's the stratum lucidum. And then this big thick layer right here, that's the stratum corneum that we have in thick skin. And these are keratinocytes that are dead, filled with what kind of chemical? Keratin, yeah, and that's a pretty tough chemical. Okay. All right, so that's the epidermis. This is a pretty good slide here because it also shows the dermis in a nice aspect. From studying for the practicum this week, you've probably run into some pictures that look like stuff down in this region right here. Right? What is my cursor kind of tracing over right here? What does that kind of look like? It looks like collagen fibers, right? And indeed, the reticular layer is loaded with collagen fibers. And in particular, the reticular layer is dense, irregular connective tissue. That's the toughest layer of the skin, right? So if you ever lacerate your skin by accident, right, it's easy to repair just by placing sutures into the dermis because this dermis has these nice strong fibers that you can actually pull skin back together and it will heal very nicely, right? Those sutures won't pull out because of all the collagen here in the reticular layer. Not so for the epidermis and this papillary region. There are very few collagen fibers in this papillary region right here. It's just an areolar connective tissue. Okay. That's pretty good for the dermis. Let's go back and look at this slide right here. All right. So again, the layers, epidermis. Right, and you should know the four or five layers in here, starting with either the superficial layer here. What's in the superficial layer? What would you call that? That's the stratum corneum, right? And then the deepest layer is the stratum basale right here, and that's the living layer, right? And then you got spinosum, granulosum, maybe lucidum in between. Okay. So then this is all the dermis, and the dermis contains blood vessels. But it also contains a lot of nerve fibers, kind of shown in yellow right here. We see free nerve endings that attach to this hair follicle right here, which means that if somebody brushes up against a hair follicle, you can feel it. Or if the wind blows up against a hair follicle, you can feel it because these are sensory receptors. And you have free nerve endings in other parts of the dermis, like right here and here. Free nerve endings are also used for pain reception. So free nerve endings are good for pain, and free nerve endings are good for temperature. There are certain nerve endings that can feel cold and certain nerve endings that can feel hot. And by comparing, your brain can compare impulses from those two nerve endings to feel what the temperature of your skin is, for instance. All right, so those are what free nerve endings are good for. All right, you also see some free nerve endings going to this thing right here. That looks kind of red, and it looks like a tiny, tiny biceps muscle. All right, so here is the muscle we were talking about. It is attached on one end to a hair follicle, and on the other end to some superficial regions of the dermis. And what does muscle specialize to do? Yeah, contract. And under certain circumstances, this is a smooth muscle. It's not a skeletal muscle. These are autonomic nerves that go to this muscle that cause it to contract. It's going to pull this hair follicle up toward the skin, right? So it's going to make this hair, instead of lying flat on the surface of the skin, is going to get it so that it points up, but it's also going to try to poke the hair follicle up toward the surface of the skin, right? It's going to try and pull that hair follicle up. And you've all seen that on yourself, right? When a little hair follicle kind of stands on end and forms a little dome right there, what is that called? That's a goosebump or a goose pimple, right? When you're cold or really anxious about something, that triggers a contraction of this muscle called the arrector pili muscle, arrector pili. And you don't really have control over that. That just happens automatically. So that's one accessory structure. All right, the nerves are another. Let's talk about some of the other nerve endings that we have. This right here that looks like an onion, a kind of a big onion, really. This is what we call a Pacinian corpuscle. And a Pacinian corpuscle is important for deep pressure and vibration, right? So almost damaging to the skin. So it's got to be a fairly significant deformation of your skin you can feel. You also have some receptors, right in the stratum basale that can sense very light vibration and pressure, right? And there are others that are in the papillary, in the dermal papillae right here, called Meissner's corpuscles. I don't see any on this slide, that are also good for very light pressure. But the Pacinian corpuscle is deep for very deep kinds of pressure. Okay. Well, what are some other accessory structures? We have some glands. And here is a gland right here, and you can see, what kind of gland is this? Is this an exocrine gland or an endocrine gland? Exocrine gland, I would say. Now, why did you choose that one? Yeah, because this gland produces a product that gets secreted into a duct, right? An exocrine gland secretes its product into a duct, and that duct carries it to where it should go in your body. In this case, to the surface of your skin, right? Carries a little salt and water to the surface of your skin, and then when that water evaporates, then that cools you down. So that's important for thermoregulation. An endocrine gland, on the other hand, has no ducts. That's the definition of an endocrine gland. It's a ductless gland that secretes a product, and that product is picked up by the circulatory system. All right, so like the thyroid gland secretes thyroid, that's an endocrine gland, and then the thyroid hormone, once it gets into the blood, where does it go? It goes everywhere in the body, because your blood goes everywhere in the body, right? But for an exocrine gland, it only goes to this one spot right there, right when right at the orifice of this duct. All right, so this right here is what we call an eccrine sweat gland. It produces just sweat to cool us down. I see another kind of gland right here and right here. It has ducts that empty into a hair follicle. And here I can see it over here as well, and here as well. All right, so is this an exocrine or an endocrine gland? It has ducts that empty into the hair follicle. So that's an example, that's another example of an exocrine gland, right? And this particular gland secretes an oily substance, right? An organic oily material that helps lubricate the motion of this hair out of the dermis and epidermis, and it actually acts like a little bacteriostatic agent. It keeps bacteria down a little bit, or it allows only the right kinds of bacteria to grow on the skin, not the pathological kind. And these are always associated with a hair follicle. We call that a sebaceous gland, and it secretes sebum, which is that oily kind of material. And there's another kind of gland, which I don't see on this diagram right here, and it's called an apocrine gland. It's bigger. It's about maybe 6 or 7 times as big as this eccrine gland. And it's found in the axilla and in the inguinal regions. Where's the axilla? Armpit. And, of course, the inguinal regions are in your groin. And those are the only two locations. And they're sweat glands, but they secrete more of an organic material. And that organic material really is not odoriferous by itself, but bacteria can metabolize it, and some bacteria have a certain odor associated with them, right? So that's why those two regions have a tendency to be a little bit more odoriferous compared to other parts of your skin. Okay, so those are some glands. You got the eccrine, which is a sweat gland, the sebaceous gland, and then the apocrine gland in those two regions of the skin. Okay, so who has got a question so far about integument? Let me see. Let me look at my slides right here. Okay. Oh, I know I got some other important things to say. All right, so a keratinocyte, right, has even a shorter lifespan than blood. A red blood cell can live for about 120 days, but a keratinocyte only maximum 45 days, right? And then they fall off your body, but that's okay because they're being replaced by live cells in the stratum basale. So don't forget, they move, right, from the basale up to the corneum, continuously moving in that direction. They start out as cuboidal or columnar cells and end up as squamous cells, And that's why we call it a stratified squamous epithelium. Okay. So there's something about the different layers. Okay. Here's a pretty good question. Glycolipid. So if you think of a lipid or a fat, does that mix with water? Like butter. No, it doesn't. All right. So that's a nice waterproofing compound. So keratinocytes secrete that glycolipid into the extracellular space, and that helps prevent you from dehydrating. Okay. Now, what about keratin? Is that intracellular or extracellular? Intracellular, right. It's not a connective tissue, right? This is an epithelium. So that keratin is a tough chemical compound that we see inside cells. All right, so here we see a layer of skin that has the basale, spinosum, granulosum, lucidum, and corneum. Now, would you say that is thick skin or thin skin? Thick skin, right? So thick skin has the stratum lucidum. Thin skin has got all of these layers with the exception of stratum lucidum. Okay. Okay, dermis, right? We talked about that already. Collagen is the major fiber that gives the dermis its strength. And in particular, what layer is that? That's in the reticular layer of the dermis. That's the deep layer of the dermis. The papillary or superficial layer is areolar connective tissue, right? It has some collagen, not very much, has some elastic fibers, but not nearly as strong as the deeper part of the dermis. All right, I want to go back and look at this slide right here. And I want to point out this hair follicle to you. Now, a lot of times, students don't think knowing layers of things are very important. But knowing layers of tissues is extremely important because that's how we can actually diagnose the health of a particular organ by looking at the various layers and to see if they're all in the proper location and well-behaved. For the skin, it's even more important, because what layer of the epidermis is the living layer? Is it the stratum corneum, the one in the middle? You're right, it's a stratum basale right here, and it would have been really nice if an artist would have drawn in maybe a couple cells in metaphase or something, because that would be might mean mitosis is taking place, that this layer is proliferating, meaning what, growing? Okay, so here's the stratum basale. Let's talk about burns for just a little bit, okay? And there are different ways we can classify burns, right? There's first degree, second degree, third degree burns, and the most insignificant kind of burn is a first degree burn, okay? First degree burn, you might burn some of these hair follicles off your skin. You don't really burn any of these keratinocytes, right, they stay intact, which means you don't really burn much of the skin below them, but that causes some inflammation of these blood vessels, right, in the papillary plexus, the dermal papillae, down in the dermis right here. So there is a little swelling and a little reddening of the skin when you have a first-degree burn, but the skin is intact. So if you have just a first-degree burn, you have to worry very much about infection or dehydration. Not too much, because your skin pretty much is intact. Maybe a little bit about infection. Probably it's not as resistant to infection as perfectly healthy skin. Okay, so that if you're out in the sun and you got a first degree burn all over your body, then that's a pretty good insult. You might want some antibiotics, okay, to help you over that. But it's not too serious a location. But these nerve fibers here, of course, are going to be irritated, and it's going to hurt like hell. Okay, that's a first degree burn. Second degree burn is when maybe you burn some of the stratum corneum off and you damage the blood vessels so much that they start to leak, not red blood cells, but plasma. And that fluid leaks out of them in these dermal papillae and then forms a blister. All right? And again, you don't have to worry too much about dehydration or infection as long as you don't pop those blisters. The integument still is pretty much intact. All right? So I would guess that you're still pretty lucky, right? Because you still have some skin over your body. All right, and if you have a first degree burn, you're actually pretty lucky because your skin's in pretty good shape. Now, a third degree burn is when you actually char off a couple layers of the epidermis right here, And that charring might go all the way down. You just turn all of this tissue into charcoal. Let's just say down to this level right here where I'm moving the cursor back and forth. All right. Now, do you think that person is lucky or unlucky?
Unlucky.
Okay, that's what I wanted you to say, but I got to change your opinion about that. I still think that person is really lucky, okay, for the following reason. When we look at a hair follicle, we say that a hair follicle produces hair, right, and that hair can act like insulation and also protection over certain parts of your body because these keratinocytes are filled with even more keratin than the keratinocytes in the skin, right? But the hair follicle acts as a reservoir for living epidermal cells, right? Which is what? What layer are the living epidermal cells in? The stratum basale, right? So right where I have the cursor, right here, that's the stratum basale. And look what happens to the stratum basale as we get to a hair follicle. Where do we see it go? All the way around the sebaceous gland. Come on, cursor. Mouse, come on. And what does it do? It dives deep, 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 deep down into the dermis. So these are still living epidermal cells right here, right? So I said that person is still lucky because why? In their integument, they still have regions where there are living epidermal cells, and these can now go and repopulate the skin, right? So that person's skin can grow back because of these living epidermal cells that are safely tucked away deep down inside the dermis, right? If they get burned only to this region here. All right, now let's think of another case of somebody with a third degree burn and they lose their skin all the way to below the level of a hair follicle, okay? Now, I would agree with you, that is a really unlucky person because now they no longer have any living epidermal cells anywhere on their skin, and what do they need? Yeah, then they need a skin graft because it will never, ever grow back after that, right? So in every particular case, right, with a third degree burn, you got to worry about infection, right? And you got to worry about dehydration. You got to keep patients hydrated. But you have to diagnose what layers, right, were damaged. And if all the layers are damaged, then they need a skin graft, right? Their skin will never grow back. So knowing these layers is really important. So it's important for staging cancers, disease processes, but also how you might want to approach the treatment of burn patients as well, right? So pay really close attention to these layers because you're going to end up in some kind of clinical practice and you'll be dealing with layers all the time because that's of prime importance to understand, okay? Okay, so that's burns and the integument. Okay, bless you. Some layers. Now, do you have any questions about layers of the skin? No? All right, what about another accessory structure? Nails. Come on, nail. Pop into the screen right there. Okay. So here we have a nail, and of course, the nails, again, are for protection, right? Protect the tips of your digits, and a digit could be a finger or a toe, right? But it could also be for self-defense, right? Could be used as claws. Most animals use them as claws as well, right? So it's important for protection. And the nail is made out of keratinocytes, just like the layers of your skin, right? So you could consider this like the stratum corneum, but it grows out from this region right here, right, which is called the nail matrix. That's the growing part of the nail, right? So then it grows from the nail matrix into the root of the nail. The root is underneath this proximal nail fold, but the root is not really the growing part anymore, right? What's a growing part? That's always a good trick question on a certification exam or anatomy exam, right? The growing part of the nail is the nail matrix, right? And then it grows into the root underneath this proximal nail fold, and then the root continues underneath the cuticle right here, which we call the epinicium, right? And then it grows out to the free edge of the nail right here. So you can damage this part of the nail just fine, you know, and it will grow back as long as you don't damage what? This tissue over here, the nail matrix that is underneath the skin, right? It will always grow back. And you might damage it severely to where it will pop off. You might get a blood blister because you have blood blisters right underneath the nail. But as long as you don't damage this nail matrix, it will grow back pretty nicely. All right, then once you get out distal to this proximal nail fold over here, then this is the body of the nail, and then this is just the free edge right here. And you can see parts of the nail matrix and the root of the nail right here, and we call that the lanula, right? So that just is the growing part of the nail right here. All right, so this actually might be, this might be an exam figure, right? So know the matrix and the root, right? Proximal nail fold, the body of the nail, and then here's the free edge. Another look. No, that's pretty much it. Yeah, it sure can. Eventually, let's go back to that one. So a fungus, right, can actually infect this whole area, the root and the nail, and then of course it will grow out with the nail, but it will always still culture itself right here over a long period of time. I suppose it could kill the matrix right here to where the nail won't be able to grow out. This is a difficult fungus to treat because, notice, there are no blood vessels in this area because, of course, this is really what? It's an epithelium, and there's no blood vessels in epithelium, and the way we deliver antibiotics is through the blood, so antibiotics can't really get into this area. I mean, antifungal agents really can't get into this area very easily, so somebody will have to take a very long course of antifungal agents to treat this kind of condition. And one of the things that's suggested sometimes if somebody has a severe fungal infection of a nail is actually to remove the whole nail without damaging the matrix, start that course of medication, and then as the nail starts to regrow again, it's not infected. All right, so that's a choice some people have to make sometimes. But I've never run into anybody that's actually lost a nail because of a fungal infection completely, killed a matrix. So you can run into some pretty ugly looking nails every once in a while, but they're still growing. Okay, so that's pretty much it for the integument. There's a good, I have for lab, I have three videos online in Blackboard that goes over all these different structures. For instance, in the integument, the different layers right here. And so you just have to become familiar with the number of layers, and maybe you should actually draw some of this out, like draw out the epidermis and label it. You know, like just draw a nice dark line right here that's a stratum basale, right? And then draw something that's not quite as dark, that's a little bit thicker, that would be spinosum. And then another dark layer right there, that would be the granulosum, and then the dead keratinocytes up over here, stratum corneum. Okay, so that you know what layers come next to what other layers. Oh, you know, one thing maybe I forgot to mention, and that is this layer right here, the hypodermis. I can't remember if I mentioned it or not. It's included in this diagram of the integument, but it's not really part of the integument. It is just a loose connective tissue that attaches your skin to underlying structures like muscle and bone, right? But it's not really part of the integument. We just talk about it right now because it's just right there for easy observation, right? And it's basically just adipose tissue, and we can store quite a bit of fat in that region right there. Okay. Oh, we could talk about some kinds of skin color, okay? Skin color can be due to basically two kinds of things. It could be due to pigments, right? And we talked about pigments. What was the name of a pigment that we talked about? Melanin, right? It's a brown to black pigment, and it's produced by melanocytes in the stratum basale, right? And so a pigment is just any kind of chemical that absorbs light. So fingernail polish has what? Pigments to give it color, right? Okay, so a pigment is just anything that produces color. Or even blood produces color because there's actually there's a pigment in blood. There's an iron atom in hemoglobin that absorbs a lot of different colors of light, except which one? Which one gets reflected back to your eyes when you look at blood? Yeah, it reflects red light back to you, right? So different kinds of skin. If you don't have a lot of melanin, then you might be able to see some of the reddish casts in people's skin, right? Due to the blood that's superficial in their skin. All right, so the natural sunscreen is called melanin, produced by those melanocytes. They're in the stratum basale. And we all have moles, and some as we get older, we get age spots too. That's an increased number of melanocytes in one little area of your body, right? And so it's a little bit darker compared to some other areas. All right, freckles, some people have freckles. That's just because in some areas, there's increased melanin production by just a normal amount of melanocytes in one area, just that some melanocytes get a little bit hyperactive and produce a little bit more melanin, okay? Then there's a condition called albinism. And it's an abnormal condition. It's not really a pathological condition, but it's abnormal because, we just don't see it very much in our population. Albinism, and it can happen to all kinds of different animals. There are tigers that have albinism, and squirrels, and deer, and people, all kinds of different mammals and other kinds of animals as well. But it's a condition where melanocytes can't produce melanin. They produce a chemical that's no longer a pigment. Right, so it doesn't absorb light, it just reflects all the light back. That's an inherited and congenital condition, that means it's not developmental, it doesn't develop over a person's lifetime, you're just born with it. And you have completely white or pink skin, completely white hair, right, and even your eyes are completely white and your fingernails are completely pink because you have absolutely no kind of brown pigment in your skin at all. And we don't see many in Southern California. Why don't we see many people with albinism in Southern California? Because the sun is so damaging, right? These people would burn their skin just by being out in the sun maybe 15 or 30 seconds, right? Because the sun is so bright here. So where would you find maybe a large population of people with albinism? Well, Alaska would be good, okay? Seattle. Okay, because it's easy for these people to have more of a normal life. They can go outside without, because the sun isn't as strong up in those kinds of places, right? All right, so that's really the only thing that they have to worry about is sunlight, right? But other than that, they're completely normal, and, you know, they look like their parents in every other respect. It's just that they're completely devoid of pigments. Cyanosis is another condition. That's an abnormal condition. And when somebody is cyanotic, they have a blue cast to their skin. And that's due to blood. When blood is oxygenated, it's a nice bright red, but when it's devoid of oxygen, it kind of looks blue, right? Maybe a kind of a reddish blue. So that means that that person is in respiratory distress, their lungs aren't working properly, and or maybe their heart is not working properly, or their heart isn't been built inside their body the correct way. And we really notice this, and we actually look at this as soon as everybody is born, right? There is a score that we score infants with. It's called an Apgar score. We look at some reflexes. We look at the color of their skin to see if it's cyanotic, look at their respiratory rate and heart rate and things like that, and come up with a score to see how healthy the baby is. And cyanosis is a very important clue. Because if their skin is kind of blue, it could mean that they have a malformation of their heart or blood vessels coming off their heart, right? And their blood isn't being oxygenated properly. And if that's the case, then we need to learn what their particular anatomy of the heart is or the anatomy of their blood vessels. Make sure they don't have any blood vessels going backwards. So what kind of scan would you order for a brand new baby that is cyanotic? What cavity would you really want to get a close look at? Like, say that one word that could be on your test. Okay, the rat? The pericardial cavity is close, but that doesn't include the blood vessels. I also want the blood vessels coming off the base of the heart. So that whole center compartment, I want a really good picture of. Yeah, the mediastinum, which contains the pericardial cavity, which is important, plus the great vessels coming off the base of the heart. Okay. Talk about another condition right here, jaundice. Jaundice is when somebody doesn't look blue, but they have a yellow cast to them. Actually, it can be a very bright yellow cast, and that's because it has to do with the blood. And remember, we talked about blood. How long does a red blood cell live for? 120 days, right? And that means that how many red blood cells do you lose every second? Because they don't live a long time. Almost 2 million every second die. Okay, and red blood cells are filled with hemoglobin, which has an iron molecule, which is a pigment. And when somebody is losing a lot of red blood cells, okay, that hemoglobin can build up in their body as a compound called bilirubin. All right, so when a lot of red blood cells get destroyed above average, you produce bilirubin, and it's usually the job of the liver to get rid of bilirubin for you. So when somebody is jaundiced, it could mean a couple things. Too many red blood cells are dying in their body, much more than normal, and that they have some kind of problem with their liver, right? Maybe liver cirrhosis. That condition can develop, for instance, if somebody's taking chemotherapy to destroy some cancers that infiltrated their liver, that also kills some of the liver tissue, and they become jaundiced. Newborn babies can become jaundiced as well. So that's another reason why we look at color when we develop an Apgar score, because there's a certain condition where the mom's immune system can attack the fetal blood circulation and kill a lot of red blood cells. And it has to do with an Rh factor. And that's why when we got married years ago, you always had to get a blood test. You don't have to do that anymore because it's so commonly diagnosed. It's easy to diagnose and prevent. But years ago, you'd have to get a blood test to find out if the dad was Rh positive and the mom was Rh negative, and that could produce jaundice, right, in their offspring. And that bilirubin is a pretty powerful neurotoxin. It will inhibit the development of the nervous system in newborn babies, so that was important to know about ahead of time. And it can be prevented if you know about it ahead of time. All right, so cyanosis is blue, jaundice is yellow due to various circumstances. And a birthmark is down in the dermis. That's just an area, right, that might look a little red, might have a little red cast to it because it has to do with an increased blood vessels in that area. So there's an extra little plexus or network of blood vessels that give that part of the skin kind of a little red look. All right, so that has to do with skin color. Okay, the accessory structures. The hair we didn't talk about much yet. The shaft of a hair lies above the surface of the skin. Okay, so where's that at? So this right here is what we call the hair shaft, right above the surface of the skin. And what else we have right here? The root and the bulb are below the surface of the skin. And that hair follicle, we talked a little bit, that's a deep invagination of the epidermis. It's a reservoir for epidermal cells. Remember, because the stratum basale goes way down into the dermis right there. And hair color is a function of the activity and the number of melanocytes in the hair bulb. And some people have kind of a red hair because a little bit of iron is incorporated in with the melanin as the hair is growing. Okay. Oh, and don't forget about that arrector pili muscle. That's an important muscle that connects between what the dermis and a hair follicle, and it makes that hair follicle stand up on end when it contracts. Okay. So that's pretty much for integument. What are the two most important functions of the integument? What's it protecting you from? Dehydration and it does protect you from sun too. Yeah, because it's got melanocytes in there. Okay, but dehydration and infection. Yeah, but I like your answer too. Protect you from the sun. That's really important. All right, so don't forget we talked about glands and nails. All right, so don't forget, tomorrow night by 11, you got another quiz. If you're having problems taking those quizzes, oh, before you go, I got a question. Let me take a question, yeah. I got to look at the schedule. We're ahead of schedule already? Yeah, oh, thanks. Oh, we're supposed to spend 2 days on tissues. Okay, and one on integument. I might review a little bit on tissues and integument and then move on to bones a little bit. Give you a little bit of an introduction on bones. Okay. All right, so this is the end of the material for the first test. All right, and tonight you got a quiz over integument and histology. Yeah, so, and then don't forget, everybody's got a practicum this week. Okay, which is anything on unit 1.